Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Spiritual Insights with Charlotte Spicer. Spirituality and Metaphysics Talk Radio, featuring A Course in Miracles, Dream Interpretation, Guided Meditation, and the Psychic and Metaphysics Free-for-All. It's your opportunity to consult with a professional psychic medium, discuss past lives, the chakras, and more. We are non-denominational, and there are no limits. Want to change your life? You must first change your mind. 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 No matter your religious structure, cultivate peace in your reality through self-awareness with an authentic spiritual teacher. And now, your host, Charlotte Spicer.
Well, hello, everyone. Thank you for joining. This is Charlotte Spicer. We have a wonderful program tonight. We will be talking and spending time with Dr. Robert Rosenthal. We'll call him Dr. Bob for the show. And Dr. Rosenthal has written the most amazing book, From Plagues to Miracles, The Transformational Journey of Exodus from the Slavery of Ego to the Promised Land of Spirit. Dr. Rosenthal is a board-certified psychiatrist and a psychotherapist in private practice in the Princeton, New Jersey area. He has been a student and teacher of A Course in Miracles since 1975. That's 37-plus years. And he's also served on the board of directors for the Foundation for Inner Peace, publisher of the course, since 1992. So Bob is intimately familiar with A Course in Miracles and was there at the beginning. So without further ado, Bob, welcome to the program, and thank you for sharing your time, your knowledge, and your experiences with us tonight.
Thanks so much, Char. It really is a pleasure being here and opening up all these wonderful topics for your listenership.
Yes, we have a lot to talk about. But I want to tell you about my impression of the book. When I first read this, I started going through profound shifts. I experienced lapses in time, a shift in perception. It really hit me profoundly. And so the testimonial I want to tell other people about this book is that because it touches on, I say the four pillars are A Course in Miracles, Judaism, translation of symbology, and then you introduce your psychotherapy practice with real-life experiences. And that had me saying, you know, I've done that to myself too. So I would say if ever there was a bridge between the Bible and A Course in Miracles, this is it. And I would highly recommend that anybody, no matter where they are on their spiritual path, get this book because there's so much to learn about yourself through the way you weave this all together. It's just phenomenal. I'm just thank you for writing it. I love it.
Well, thanks so much. One of the I can't say my intention, but I think one of Spirit's intentions in guiding me to write this particular book was to weave together the Bible, which comes to us just so encrusted with, belief structures from other times, from other people. I just received an email the other day from a new reader who said she'd always wanted to be able to read the Bible and find what was spiritual in it, but every time she picked it up, she couldn't get very far. So one of the intentions, I think, is to link the two, to bridge, and to show how the Bible stories, in particular the story of Exodus, is a metaphor, an allegory, a parable that shows us how to reach Spirit, how to reach God, and therefore really links A Course in Miracles, other spiritual systems, and the good old Bible.
It's funny you said that, because I'll admit I don't read the Bible. I'm not a biblical scholar by any stretch of the imagination.
The reason was
because every time I opened it, I wanted to. But every time I opened it, I would have a literal allergic reaction. I would start sneezing. I would start coughing, tears, in my eyes, and I had to close it. And so I did the logical thing. I thought, well, maybe the book is old and I'm allergic to dust. So I went and bought a new one. And then I bought another one, and it kept happening. And it was a real deterrent. And the only thing I could figure was maybe it was something karmic, because I have a big issue with the notion that people did go in there and rearrange things for the purpose of manipulating others. And as a last desperate attempt, I said, well, maybe you're having this reaction to it, and that's your biggest issue with it, because maybe you have some part in that. So what I did was I forgave, not knowing what to forgive, but just doing a blanket statement of forgiveness for whatever is blocking me from wanting to read the Bible, and it went away completely. But after reading your book, it's funny that you said that lady said that. After reading your book, now I really want to read the Bible, but from this new perspective I have of really breaking down the story of Exodus in such a way that it really helped me, and it made me remember a lot of things from a fresh light, and just started the whole process over again, and I was extremely peaceful for several weeks after reading it. But so let's just jump right in. I want to.
Well, if I can just address
sure.
that, you know, you had said that you would react to kind of your innate knowingness that the words of the Bible, the words of truth, had been at times twisted, at other times, you know, just mistranslated. I mean, after all, the Hebrew Bible went, you know, from Hebrew into many other languages. The New Testament, you know, Jesus spoke in Aramaic, and that was never written down. You know, we only have the record in ancient Greek, which then went to Latin, which then went to all of the, you know, Indo-European languages. So there's so much room for error, and all along the way, the various scribes who were, you know, copying down the Bible in cold medieval cells with poor lighting and, you know, would make an error in the Latin. All along the way, there's just so much room for mistranslation. So one of the things that I like to ask myself is, if I were trying to convey truth in a form that would carry on through the ages with the least distortion, would that be in the actual words? Obviously not. The words are easy, you know, the words, we don't even know the meaning of the words from one language to another. I mean, the word that got translated as virgin in the New Testament of the Virgin Mary in ancient Greek means a young woman. So really, you know, the New Testament said Jesus was born of a young woman. So words are not a good way to carry truth across the generations. But a story, when you tell a story, the words may change, but the essence of the story is there. We can all tell the story of the Three Bears or Little Red Riding Hood, and we'll all use different words, and we may even change certain scenes here and there, but the fundamental essence of the story will carry through. And therefore, I think when we look at the stories of the Bible, rather than trying to parse the meanings of the words, or, you know, there's a series of books called the Bible Code that look at the Hebrew lettering and the, you know, when they do a skip count from different letters to try to predict the future, you know, those things, they would change so rapidly. I think the truth lies in the story, and that's what I've tried to bring to the surface in Exodus, is a story that when you peel away the surface level becomes a roadmap, a guide for how to proceed along the spiritual journey, the journey back to our true identity as God or Spirit. Does that make sense?
That makes perfect sense. But if you were not, as you said when I said I really don't read the Bible, and you were like, you know, what inspired you to write this in the first place, and kind of bridge the two, and weave all these elements in? What was your inspiration?
Well, that's the $64,000 question, and to answer that, I really almost have to pull together, you know, strands from many different places in my life. But what I would say first and foremost is this is where the tie-in to A Course in Miracles takes place. There's absolutely no way that I could have read Exodus and looked at it in the way that I now do if I weren't the beneficiary of the teachings of A Course in Miracles. So the origins of my book, of From Plagues to Miracles, really lies back in 1975 when I was first introduced to A Course in Miracles. If your listeners would be interested in that, I can certainly jump in and share something from that time.
Yeah, I want to know.
Yeah, so my story is...
All the way back to the beginning. Take us there.
Okay. I was listening to your interview last week with Carol Howe, which I thought was absolutely wonderful. And you and Carol were talking about, well, how did you find the course? And at a certain point, Carol said, well, you know, the course finds you. And in my instance, that is absolutely true. I wasn't looking for A Course in Miracles. It hadn't been published yet. But my college roommate, his mother was Judy Scutch, who I met in, the fall of 1974, I'm guessing. Mm-hmm. So before she came upon A Course in Miracles. We were both very interested in the Seth material, which was another channeled work. And when she came, when she was introduced to the course in May of 75, she said to me, I've got this system of spirituality that I have to show you. It took many, many more months, but over the Christmas holiday of 75, I was staying with her son at their, you know, at their New York house, and she showed me the course, and it was in these big black thesis binders, and so I wasn't looking for it at all. And in fact, my first reaction to the course was kind of lukewarm. Some part of me really resonated and knew, wow, this is big. This is important stuff. Pay attention. You know how sometimes you know, those lights and bells sort of go off as spirit's way of making sure we pay attention. But at the ego level, I was feeling like, well, wait a minute, this isn't like the Seth material. You know, that tells me that I'm an individual on a path. I reincarnate. I learn more with each incarnation. You know, it's sort of this wonderful, you know, playground where you learn more and more and more. And the course is kind of saying, no, it's all illusion, and there is no happiness there. And, you know, happiness and peace lie with remembering who you are and returning to God. So that was not where I was at the time. But in the ensuing months, I did experience a number of absolute miracles that I had no other way of explaining, and that were powerful enough that they shook my worldview sufficiently for me to say, okay, I get it. Let me pay attention. This is for me.
Yes.
And then that summer, June of 1976, was when the course was published. As it turned out, I was living in Judy and Bob Scutch's apartment. At the time, I was taking physics, pre-med physics at Columbia, which was absolutely miserable. Hated it.
Aww.
But it put me in, you know, right at ground zero where the course was actively being published. So Helen and Bill were there frequently all the time.
Okay.
I met Bill. Bill Thetford and I had an instantaneous connection. I felt like I'd known him. And I think to his credit, I never felt like a child or a kid. I felt like he always recognized, you know, something in me that I could, you know, respond to. And from there, you know, the course has been with me ever since. I joined the board of the foundation when I moved out to the West Coast. It was probably 1992 or 93. I've taken, you know, periods of time where, you know, I haven't worked the lessons actively, but it's always been the cornerstone of my spiritual path.
Yes.
So without A Course in Miracles, I'm definitely not writing from plagues to miracles.
Obviously, but what stands out is, so you started studying out of binders? It literally was not published, and you had binders with the material in it?
When Bill and Helen first finished and did their editing, they made, I think it was a dozen copies that they put into thesis binders, and their belief at the time was that there couldn't be more than a dozen people on the entire planet who would have any interest in this material at all. So they certainly weren't thinking, you know, this is going to be any kind of a world changer. So it was in the binders. There were, you know, it was typewritten. There were corrections. And then from there, it was Xeroxed from the binders, Xeroxed. So I'm even using an archaic word. It was photocopied into you know, I mean, it was the same photocopy, but it was kind of condensed and shrunk and put into these paperback books, two volumes for the text, one for the workbook, one for the manual for teachers. We call that the Criswell edition. There's actually, on the Foundation for Inner Peace website, there's a link to the Foundation archives, which has photos of all of the various incarnations of the books and a very good history of, you know, of the printings and how the books came to be. But so that was, and those were the first editions that I had. So for the first 6 months until it was officially published, yeah, we were working out of these, you know, very tiny print Xerox books bound together that if you pulled it apart too far, the whole thing fell apart. And that was the start of A Course in Miracles.
That's amazing. And you say in the book that you were at the celebration dinner at Judy's house. I feel like I know her. I don't know why, but I feel like I know her. You were at, they had a celebration dinner at her house and you were in attendance?
Yeah, in June of 76, I was living there, and when the first books were delivered, the vestibule of her apartment, hers and Bob's, was, you know, there were piles of boxes. The first printing was 5,000, but I'm pretty sure they didn't do 5,000 right off the bat. But when those were printed, they held a dinner for Helen and Bill. Ken Wapnick was there. Jerry Jampolsky was there, obviously, Bob and Judy. There may have been other people. I don't recall. But, yeah, Judy invited me there. I think she's far-seeing enough that she just intuitively knew I would have some role in this process, which was far more than I knew. I felt kind of like, wow, what am I doing here? It truly did feel surreal. And yet at the same time, I very much felt like I did belong there. You know, it wasn't a fish out of water feeling. It was just kind of like, all right, I'm here, but I have no clue what this is about.
But it feels right.
And at that dinner, they presented Helen and Bill with beautiful leather-bound editions of the course. And, you know, it was very celebratory. I don't think Helen and Bill ever even thought that it would become a published volume.
That's amazing. And just to see, to imagine all of you there sitting at a table knowing that it was significant, feeling that it's right, but there was no way any of you could have known that it would be what it is today.
Absolutely not.
And Judy, sounds like Judy was totally guided in her role, and everybody's playing their role, and now look at what your role has become, because even though the story is fascinating, it feels totally natural to me. You're navigating your life the best way you know how, and it found you, like it finds all of us.
Yes, exactly.
And
you know,
you're
we wind up where we
it.
Need to be. We yes. wind up where we need to be, even though much of the time we have no clue why, and often it's only in retrospect that we, you know, we look back and we go, oh, that's why that happened.
Yes.
Okay, now it makes sense. But at the time, we don't know, and the course is pretty clear. I mean, you know, the voice of Jesus made very clear to Helen, you know, and I believe to Judy as well, you don't need to know the whole picture. You don't need to know what's going to happen 5 or 10 years from now. If you did know, all it would do is create fear.
Fear.
And there's no point to having fear.
Yeah.
I like the analogy. I forget whether it's Wayne Dyer or John Bradshaw or one of those guys who used it. That,
I love them both.
You know, yeah, that you can drive, you know, 500 miles in the night seeing only the distance of your headlights. I think that's a very, very wonderful metaphor for trusting spiritual guidance, because we all want to know, well, you know, gee, if I take this path, you know, where am I going to be 5 years from now? Will I have enough money? Will my friends still love me? And we don't need to know that far in the future,
yeah.
You know?
No, I used to, you know, as a psychic, I used to peek all the time out of fear, peeking around the corner. What's going to happen when I go through that door? You know, are they talking about me? You know, all these fearful things, and doing the course broke me out of that very quickly. And I'm able to say, I don't know what's going to happen, but I know it'll be okay, and I'm not worried about the outcome.
Wonderful. And you notice, you're much less scared, which means your guidance is also going to be better.
Exactly. Because my mind
is better. We're better receivers when we're not vibrating to fear.
Right. Wow.
So that was my early history with the course. But then there was one other phase that probably is worth mentioning.
Okay.
And again, in terms of, you know, looking back on your life and understanding something in a different way, at the time that this took place, it was very much a tragedy for me. It was, you know, what I would certainly call a plague. In retrospect, it was an incredible gift. In my last year of medical school, so that would have been, I think, 1980 or 80 to 81, we were allowed to take off up to, I think it was about two and a half months of time, and I had arranged to travel around the world. And in fact, I was meeting up with Judy's son, who was traveling around in the other direction, and we were going to hike all over New Zealand. And
wow.
Then I was going to continue on to Thailand and India, and he was headed home. So we're in New Zealand, and, you know, we hike 6 miles up this difficult trail to a cabin and, you know, spend the night. And the next day, not more than 3 minutes out from the cabin, I'm stepping onto a rock that's kind of slick, and my foot slips off it, and I hear a snap. And,
oh.
Hey, I'm a medical student. I know when I broke a bone. And I limp back to the hut, and they tell me, hey, sorry, you have to just hike out of here. So I tried to put my boot back on, and my leg was too swollen. I couldn't get it on.
Oh, my God.
And I sat there for 2 days until finally they lifted me out by helicopter and got me to a hospital. So
I have
clearly,
to ask, which leg was it? The left or the right?
It was my left. My left.
Okay. Yeah, that's what I figured.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah,
I
at that time,
like that.
The injuries were mostly, I believe, left injuries at that point. Or, you know, it's funny. It's so long ago, it feels like another lifetime. So I can't even remember clearly, but I'm pretty sure it was my left.
Yeah.
But the consequence of that was I couldn't travel around the world, so I went back to the U.S. But rather than going back to where I lived in Philadelphia, I went back to Tiburon, and I lived for about 5 weeks with Bob Scutch. And at that time, Bob lived in a house right on the water in Tiburon, on the bay opposite Angel Island. If you walked a short distance down Mar East, you got to Jerry Jampolsky's house. Jerry had a beautiful place with a huge open-air deck. And then if you walked a little further, well, that's where Bill Thetford was renting space. And they would get together every morning to do a course lesson. Bill would read it out loud, and then we'd all, you know, they'd meditate and discuss
right.
it. Jerry would ask a lot of questions. So for over a month, I got to, you know, walk over and participate in that, got to hang out with Bill at length. From Plagues to Miracles is all about how what the ego sees as a plague to spirit can be used to transform into a miracle. So here's this tragedy. I wanted to go around the world. I wanted new adventures and experiences. Oh, didn't happen. And instead, I get to hang out in Tiburon with, you know, three amazing people who you know, were each in their own way formative to my spiritual path. And I do believe that that was where my grounding in the course really went deep.
Absolutely. Because as I'm hearing you, what you did, you wanted to go out and see the world, and instead you took an intensive with the three people who would be the strongest to guide you to rise above it, to rise above the very world that you set out to go check out.
And, of course, Judy was there, ever present. I mean, Judy really is, you know, my mother in the lineage of spirit, and and has always, you know, felt like family in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, and you know, when you're around Judy, you meet the most fascinating people. She's just a magnet for that. So, you know, I met a lot of really neat people, but most of all, I think just being in those morning meditations.
Yeah.
I can still hear Bill's voice reading the course. Nobody read A Course in Miracles the way Bill Thetford did.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my! And I just—it just feels like a family.
Yes.
A very big family, a large family, but monumental in its purpose. And you got to, you know, be pulled under their wing like their son. I think that's perfect. I love it.
Yeah, and at that point, I mean, I certainly wasn't thinking, gee, what's the future of the foundation, or will I be a part of this? I mean, it really, that wasn't of interest. In fact, it probably wasn't until From Plagues to Miracles came into my life that I actually started thinking, yeah, you know, I probably should teach this, in part because when in the writing of From Plagues to Miracles, I had to give some real thought to what is the meaning of the promised land. You know, after all, right. The goal of Exodus is let's get to the promised land. And
out of enslavement. Mm-hmm.
Yes. But Exodus really doesn't tell us what the promised land was like, other than, you know, it's a land of milk and honey. And then there's a long passage in Deuteronomy about, you know, it's a place of, you know, pure water and all the various foods and fruits and things that you can eat. But, you know,
yeah.
How does that translate as a symbol into the spiritual path? You know, obviously it's not about moving someplace that, you know, that becomes the promised land, whether that's, you know, Israel or Canaan or
like
or California.
Mirage.
I'm sorry?
Yeah, I'm thinking of a mirage in the desert. We can't suppose mm-hmm. what the outcome looks like that would bring you that peace.
Yeah,
so in the book it's that step-by-step process.
Yes. So when I was thinking about what is the promised land, and what, you know, one section I asked myself, well, what do we do when we're in the promised land? And the answer that came to me was, well, there isn't any doing, because doing is of the body and the ego. But what is our purpose? Well, it can only be the same as Moses. We're there to lead other people, our brothers and sisters in spirit. We're there mm-hmm. to lead them out of slavery as well. So from that sense, we are all true. I mean, the Course makes this abundantly clear. We're all students. We're all teachers. When I say I was a student and teacher of A Course in Miracles from 1975, I was teaching it then, but I was teaching it to myself. But we all, you know, the moment we turn and embrace a spiritual awareness that there's more here than meets the eye, that my happiness does not lie in acquiring the things of this world, but that there is a reservoir of peacefulness, love, beauty, even creativity within each of us, that once we turn in that direction and tap it, now we're en route to the promised land, and that's where we'll get our miracles. And for learning purposes, we'll get our plagues too. Make sense?
Make perfect sense. I just, you know, it's a huge concept. I mean, the whole parable of Exodus, to look at it now through you helping us see it through your eyes, and the whole idea of enslavement.
Yeah.
It's really huge, because we all do that, the possessions, the money, the time, obsession with the physical body. Can you elaborate on
the
whole concept of enslavement?
One of my favorite parts of Exodus. One of the reasons I realized that nobody has seen Exodus as a parable was because we take slavery literally. So certainly, you know, for many and most people in the first world countries, you know, we're not enslaved. You know, we generally get by. I mean, we have our hard times, but we're not in chains. We're not, we're not oppressed, we don't think. And if you look at it that way, well, Exodus simply doesn't apply. Now, the African-American experience in this country is a very different thing. And, you know, when they relate it to Exodus in the 60s and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., that's why Exodus spoke so powerfully to their plight. But for the rest of us, it's easy to kind of go, you know, that really isn't relevant. But the
most of us don't have that.
Right. But the
don't
moment
have those experiences,
we... Yeah, we're not enslaved. You know, I mean, I can get in my car and drive anywhere in this country. You know, I guess as long as I'm not, you know, trying to get into some federal base that I'm not allowed in or something.
Sure, we have to follow the rules.
Right. But so then what is slavery? I mean, if this is applying to all of us, we have to look at, well, where are we enslaved? And as I see it, the Jewish or the Judeo-Christian concept of enslavement is the equivalent of the Buddhist concept of suffering, dukkha. That as long as we're in this world, in a body, run by the ego, as long as the ego, which in Exodus is represented by the Pharaoh. As long as the ego is our taskmaster, then we are enslaved. So if we're enslaved, what are we enslaved to? As you just said, we're enslaved to our possessions. You know, I buy an iPhone, now I've got to get the contract, now I need to get the apps. Ooh, this app isn't working. Now I'm upset and frustrated with that. Now they're doing an upgrade, I need to get the upgrade.
I need more.
More. I mean,
more, bigger, better.
A very material, consumer-oriented culture. And it's not that there's anything wrong with having possessions. I mean, it's nice to have creature comforts. That's part of what spirit actually can bring to us to help us in our fear. But when that becomes a slavish pursuit and we feel like we have no other choice, that's a different story. We're enslaved to money. I don't know if I've ever met anyone who didn't have some fear or lusting after money. You know, it's just that ever present. It's that associated with survival. We're enslaved to time. We've only got 24 hours in a day. We've only got the one lifetime that we live. One of my favorite lines is, "There are no billionaires in the world of time." You know, we all get the same allotment. So we rush about frantically trying to cram everything in, and we never do. And I don't know about you, but I'm sure you know what I'm talking about here.
Yes.
It seems like every 6 months there's more and more to keep up with. I mean, I can spend an hour and a half every night going through all of my various emails and wading through them, you know, and then text messages and trying to keep up with the news and all the news outlets. It becomes pretty insane.
And with all this technology, and we're busier than ever, when you would think it would save us time, and
that's the trap.
Burdened under it. It's ridiculous. But I want to clarify for the listeners, in your book, From Plagues to Miracles, we have the story of Moses leading the Egyptian slaves to the promised land, freedom, and away from Pharaoh. And I just want to clarify that Pharaoh, as you said earlier, I wanted to touch on this real quickly. Mm-hmm. Pharaoh represents the ego, whereas Moses represents the part of us that is always and forever connected to God. So as these two adversaries, our true nature, our true identity as children of God and connected to God, versus the viciousness of the ego and it wanting to keep us captive and believe that without it, we wouldn't survive. So I wanted to kind of paint that picture, and you go ahead and comment on that.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I kind of got ahead of myself there. The best way to understand Exodus as a roadmap for the spiritual journey is recognizing that it's not about an outer journey, it's about an inner journey, and that Pharaoh and Moses represent aspects of our minds. So in Exodus, Pharaoh enslaves the Hebrew people. They're living free, they're doing well, and out of nowhere, out of truly a paranoia, I mean, the Exodus says that Pharaoh kind of looked around and said, gee, you know, there are a lot of these Hebrews. What if they joined our enemies and, you know, came against us? That would be terrible. Let's put them into slavery. And, you know, there's no indication that they were plotting against anyone. They were very happy in Egypt. Why would they ever rebel or join the enemies? But this is the nature of ego. The ego, because it's fearful, because it's insecure, always asks these what-if structured questions. What if the catastrophe happens? And the moment we do that, we are literally enslaved to fear. There's no answer that we can come up with that's going to truly bring us peace from that fear. On the other hand, we have Moses. And at the beginning of Exodus, Pharaoh tries to kill the Hebrew people. And by the way, the Hebrews represent all of us. This is not about one small religious group. They, you know, as Gary Renard said in his blurb and review for my book, the Hebrews are the choosers. You know, do I stay here with Pharaoh? Do I follow Moses to freedom? So Moses is the part, as you just said so well, that has never lost its connection to God. And when Pharaoh, in the beginning of Exodus, Pharaoh issues these decrees, all Hebrew boys are to be killed. Well, what happens? you know, they put Moses on the river. He's floating by the banks. And who saves him? Pharaoh's own daughter. You know, so this is how powerful spirit is. You know, right under the eyes of the ego comes, I like to think of it as the female principle of safety, and helps Moses grow up despite her own father's decree to murder him. So yes,
yes.
No, go ahead.
No, I just,
okay.
Yeah.
So
it unfolds.
Go ahead,
continue.
Yeah, as Exodus unfolds, what we get to see is Moses is raised in the palace of ego. He's raised in the Pharaoh's palace. What does that mean? Well, we all grow up in the land of ego. Very few of us, you know, are raised in a monastery or some kind of a real, deeply spiritual family. So we learn the values of ego. And when Moses learns the values of ego, what does he do? Well, the first time he's visiting his people, or at least it sounds like the first time, he sees an Egyptian beating a Hebrew slave, and he kills the guy. So armed with the tools of ego, Moses behaves like ego. He commits a murder. And
yes.
The result of the murder is he has to flee. There's a price on his head. He goes into exile. He leaves behind his people.
Yes.
So even though his intention was to free his people, he can no longer do that. But the Moses mind retains its connection, and even though Moses tries to settle into a comfortable domestic routine with his father-in-law's flocks, at a certain point, and I like to think of this as when he's more mature,
yeah,
what happens? He runs into the burning bush. And the burning bush is one of the really the second miracle of Exodus. The first miracle is that Moses survives. I like
yes.
to, you know, in Harry Potter terms, Moses was the original boy who lived.
Right.
But when
right.
Moses sees the burning bush, you know, he's reactivated. He remembers, oh yeah, this is my purpose. But now he goes into Egypt with God behind, with God's support.
And with that, from going from one scenario to a period of isolation, and then he is tending the flocks with his father-in-law and trying to be without purpose, and then you hear that call,
yes,
and he knows he has to act now to free the slaves, and then
yes,
get back there. Okay.
Knows that this is his purpose, and that is the purpose of the part of the mind that I refer to as the Moses mind, but it's also the Christ mind, it's the sonship, it's the Holy Spirit.
Yes.
It's that which is inextricably a part of us. You can't lose it. You can push it away, you can run, you can forget about it for years and probably lifetimes, but it's always there patiently waiting. This is how I think the story, the parable of the prodigal son, is best understood. You know, you can spend and waste and throw away all of your father's gifts to you,
mm-hmm,
but at the end of the day, when you're done with all that dissolution and you've tried to find happiness everywhere you thought it might exist, and you come crawling back home, those gifts are still there for you, and you're welcomed with open arms, because in the eyes of the Father, in the eyes of God, you didn't do anything wrong. You didn't
right.
do anything wrong. You're always welcome back. So, yeah, in the parable of Exodus, Moses gets his activation codes in the burning bush. He wakes up. He goes in. He confronts Pharaoh. Now
mm-hmm.
he's not murdering people. To me, one of the best lessons that Exodus shows us is when the plagues start to happen,
mm-hmm,
you know, Moses is just the go-between. You know, he kind of says to God, okay, what do I do? And God says, oh, I want you to go down to the Nile and, you know, and with Aaron
yeah.
and take your staff and do this, and the Nile will turn to blood. Okay, he does it, you know. Pharaoh is not impressed, and, you know, Moses doesn't freak out, or, you know, he simply turns back to God and goes, okay, what next?
Yeah,
and if we could each live that way,
mm-hmm,
think for a second, if we each lived that way, if any time something seemed not to go right, if we just said, okay, I don't understand this, but tell me what's next, boy, what a different world it would be.
It is different, and I think we can all look back at, let's say, negative instances that were truly life lessons and see the blessing that came out of it. And I do think that God, no matter what tragedies befall us, he makes something good come of it, and he helps us learn the lessons that we came here to learn. And no matter how many times and how many different ways we want to, if we sticking with these terms of plagues as trials and tribulations, we want to, as human beings, the ego wants to blame God for the things that happen in our life and transfer our feelings about our life, our parents, you know, that whole transference thing, and blame him for the plagues when he's really helping us through what we created for ourselves. And since we're on the topic of plagues, with the 10 plagues that take place in Exodus, how would you say that, as we call them, plagues or problems, how would you say that plagues are part of the spiritual journey for us in this era, in this time?
That's a great question, and I think it goes right to the heart of the matter, Shar. In this sense, so many of us, and I include myself, in the not too distant past in this category, embrace New Age philosophies, embrace the idea that, you know, if you clear out all the negativity, you can have anything you want. You know, you can have the perfect partner, the 5,000 square foot house with the swimming pool and the perfect dog, and you know, you can manifest it all. And I don't necessarily dispute that, but I say, where's the learning value in that? Now, at the early part of the path, if you believe that you are just simply the victim of the world that you live in, and sort of subject to the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, to quote Hamlet, then yeah, it really does help to see, oh, you mean my thoughts actually do have an influence on reality? Well, let me create some good stuff. And I think at an early part of the path, that does happen. And that's a very useful lesson to get. But at a certain point, what's that teaching you? Well, it's teaching you that you should be happy as an ego in a body in physical reality. You're going to die.
It's not possible.
It's probably not going to be pretty.
It's not possible. The ego doesn't want you to be happy. One of my favorite quotes from A Course in Miracles is that the ego will forever have you chasing what it does not want you to find.
So yes, the ego's motto is seek, but do not find.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
The ego's motto is seek, but do not find. The ego loves seeking, but it will not point you in the direction, where there really is an answer.
No, it says look over there. That person will make you happy, or that job will make you happy.
Yeah, all the false distractions of ego. But so back to the plagues, and I think this is where Exodus is such a powerful teacher when we understand it properly.
Right.
The purpose of the plagues is, you know, and again, we're using plagues metaphorically. Trials and tribulations probably is a better term. But since we're talking Exodus, it's plagues.
Yes. Yeah, stick with plagues and Moses and Pharaoh.
So we have to – they're actually there's a Czech language translation of From Plagues to Miracles coming out, and the translator wrote to me and said, you know, the word plagues is a pretty horrible word in Czech. You know, can we come up with a different title? And I sort of laughed, and I said, you know, sure. No, I said it's okay. You know, I mean, I'd rather someone not be turned off by the cover. And yes, most people do judge a book by its cover, but plagues are instrumental. So what the plagues are, and again, if you look at Exodus, when do plagues come? Well, it's when Pharaoh won't let go. Plagues are the convincers. Plagues are what come about to try to break ego's hold on us. Our attachments, our aversions. So when a plague shows up, it's just exposing some place where we're still attached to ego and its values. And what Pharaoh in Exodus shows us is that the harder we hold on, the worse that plague will get. If you get that lesson right away, you transcend it, and the Red Sea parts. And, you know, I mean, if Pharaoh had listened at the first plague and said, you know, this makes a lot of sense. Thank you, Moses. I don't want to keep the Hebrew people in bondage. You're free to go. Then, you know, Egypt would have done a whole lot better than it did in Exodus. But it's his intransigence, it's his refusal to let go that causes the plagues to escalate and get worse and worse and worse until finally they break him. But they break ego. They don't break spirit. So when ego is afflicted
right.
with hardships and plagues, that actually is a miracle for spirit. You know, I always like to think that, you know, the plagues are plagues for the Egyptians, but they don't touch the Hebrew people, you know. They don't really affect the essence of who we are. Our spiritual essence is, you know, it's kind of like we're locked in, you know, in marble, and the plagues are this tool for chipping it all away, or, you know, we're mm-hmm. encased in dirt, and the plagues are the shower that comes and washes it all off so that we can be exposed to our genuine true nature.
Right.
So without plagues, I don't think you advance on the spiritual path. And this is understood. I mean, you know, there's a Rumi poem that expresses this beautifully.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Zen teacher Adyashanti talks about this. You know, all of the great spiritual traditions talk about, you know, suffering as a path to realization. And this is really a key. It's not that suffering has virtue in itself. And I think
No.
this is in place, you know, where certain elements of Christianity misunderstand the notion of sacrifice. It's
Right.
not that God wants you to sacrifice and suffer. It's just that the suffering exposes where we, as you said, still are attached, still cling to our ego identity, where we still let Pharaoh run the show.
Right.
So to the extent that we can, you know, welcome them, or if not welcome them, accept them, guess what? Transformation starts to happen. And in my experience, and in the experience of the people I work with in psychotherapy, as I try to share in From Plagues to Miracles in the book, that's where the miracle shows up. You know?
Right.
And I've been fortunate enough to witness, you know, some amazing ones. You know, I not too long ago had one person who felt that she was in an impossible relationship with her father. It had never gone well. We started talking. I think just through talking, you know, we kind of let it go. And when I talked to her the next week, I was like, okay, how'd it go? Miracle, you know?
Yeah.
Father came to her, started crying, apologized for everything. This is the kind of transformation you get when you change your inner world. The outer will match it and mirror it.
And start to detach
your
identification,
law.
Right?
Yes.
So she
yes.
had to miss, kind of retreat from her identification of who her biological father was, his role, all of that junk in her head, and because she was no doubt picturing the worst outcome, and so by your account, she actually wound up with the opposite.
Well, yeah,
which
it's
is
kind
what
of like she was stuck in the anger and the sense of righteousness. One of my favorite quotes from A Course in Miracles, and I wish they made it into a bumper sticker because I'd certainly put it on my car. Would you rather be right or happy? Every single couple I work with, I try to remember to ask them that. Because you know what? If you want to be right, you can be right, but you sure won't be happy. You'll be in conflict with everyone because you know what? Their egos think that they're right too. On
yeah.
the other hand, if our goal is happiness, and let's expand happiness to include peace, love, joy, you know, all that good stuff that all of us want.
Right.
Well, if we want to be happy, we need to let go of our notion that we know what's right. We don't. Only God and Holy Spirit know that. You know,
and we have to be open.
That's their purpose. We have to be open. So I think what happened with this person is that, you know, in the tug of war with her father, where they were each pulling as hard as they could, you know, she sort of let go of her end of the rope and he kind of went flying a little bit. But in flying, he realized, oh, my God, I love my daughter, and was able to, you know, come to her with that level of vulnerability.
And,
which changed
and that
everything.
Happened. And that happened the moment she, quote, let go.
Bingo.
Right.
Exactly right.
She let go of the rope. When you reach the end of your rope, you know what? You know, we struggle to hang on to the end of that rope, thinking that, you know, total annihilation is going to occur. But for me and in my journey with A Course in Miracles, I learned that to let go is to be in control. When we're worried and we're chasing and we're convincing ourselves and everybody who will listen that a new job will bring us what we want, a new partner will bring us what we want. If I could just change this person, if this person would just be who I want them to be, everything will be perfect. And, you know, we can't do that. So when we do let go, of all of that, that is when those miracles occur.
Exactly.
And I'm happy that happened for her. Yeah.
I like to think of it in terms of changing the operating system. So we think of it as letting go because we are identified with ego. And from an ego perspective, it's letting go. The other way of looking at it, though, is we are, you know, we're split minds. We have within us both Moses and Pharaoh, both the Christ mind and the ego. So letting go is simply the act of recognizing, ego's been running the show, and as the Course says, let me choose once again. I am the chooser. I am the decider. The power of decision is my own, to quote a Course lesson. So the moment we let go, what we're really doing is saying to ego, you know what? I'm not going to let you be in charge of this one. I don't know how to do it, I being ego, so I'm going to turn it over. And yet in turning it over, what we get to discover is the miracle, which always proceeds in ways we never could have imagined. You know, God's resources are so outstrip our own that, you know, it's not even worth comparing. But it's a shift from one part of the mind to the other. And that's what we have to let go of is the ego. That's the only thing you need to let go of.
And get into your right mind and stay there as long as possible. And I think, you know, an important part of it when we look at our lives, and, you know, we are on the planet, we have to navigate our way. But don't condemn your plagues and don't block the miracles, because when they don't happen, the Course says, you know, when they do not occur, something has gone wrong.
That's right. Miracles are natural. When they do not occur, something has gone wrong, which tells us that the natural state, what I like to call the flow state, is, you know, you don't have to think about anything. It all works out. I like to reference on that. There's an old cartoon, and I'm probably showing my age when I refer to it, called Mr. Magoo.
I love Mr. Magoo.
You know, okay. So you know how Mr. Magoo, he's got no vision. He can't see where he's going.
Right.
But no matter what he does, he just seems to come out right. You know, all around him, you know, there's calamity. It's kind of like that. You know, we can walk through the valley of the shadow of death, discovering it is just a shadow, and it doesn't touch us. Or there's a wonderful scene in the movie Little Big Man with Dustin Hoffman, where his Native American adoptive father, who is blind, they're in the middle of a battle, and he says, you know, no, we're invisible. They can't see us. And, of course, they're not invisible, but he just leads this guy right through the battle, and sure enough, nobody sees them. And, you know, he's got this big grin on his face. That's what the state of flow is like. Problems, I like to think of it as, we don't solve problems, they just disappear in front of us. We don't even know they're there sometimes, because we've made a choice for spirit, rather than looking at it and trying to figure out, how do we plan this? What do we do with this? And that, to me, this is where Exodus is so important. If we had to plan crossing the Red Sea, you know, I mean, what, we'd be tying logs together for rafts, or trying to figure out how the wind is blowing and the tides and what's the right time to do it.
And it's too much right there. And no matter what problem we have, no matter, you know, the ego perceived size, and no matter how big or small you think the problem is never as big as the fear you're attaching to it.
Yep. So, and in fact, the problem is the fear we're attaching to it.
Exactly. And crossing through an ocean really shouldn't be difficult at all when you are in your right mind and you know and you trust that God will find a way across.
If crossing the Red Sea is on your spiritual path, I guarantee you there will be a way across when the time comes that you're ready for it.
Yeah, when you're right.
And it is, you know, it's a wonderful metaphor in that it's something, I mean, in Exodus, let's put it in context. The Hebrew people, you know, the 10th plague has happened. Pharaoh has said, get out of here. I don't even want to see you guys anymore. You know, you've brought me all this bad stuff, these 10 plagues. So they go, you know, the door opens and they go and they leave. And then Pharaoh, being the ego, he doesn't know what else to do, goes, you know what? I made a bad decision. I'm going to go get them and put them back into slavery.
Right.
All the ego knows how to do is enslave. So there's this standoff on the banks of the Red Sea where Pharaoh and his armies have caught up to the Hebrew people, but God wraps them all in mist so that the Egyptians can't see the Hebrew camp. But the Hebrew position is they are truly between the rock and the hard place, or
right.
the water and the hard. You know, there's this uncrossable sea in front of them. There's this huge army in back of them. There is no way out. If you study a map of the Gulf of Aqaba, which is probably what they really crossed, not the Red Sea,
mm-hmm.
I mean, there are these huge bluffs with narrow valleys, and they're probably stuck on, you know, sort of a beach area between these high. I mean, there is no way out. It looks like, you know, it's your classic ego, we're all going to die.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens? The Red Sea parts, and suddenly where there was no way forward, there is.
Something opens, and you see the escape route, and, you know, that's how we all feel between a rock and a hard place, or, you know, in something that we can't get out of, and we don't see a way out, and we're so wrapped with fear, and then it opens up, and you can put one foot in front of the other and move on.
And that's the miracle. And it's not because, you know, we did well or because, you know, we earned it. We all earn it. It's waiting there for all of us all the time. The moment we change operating systems from, you know, from the ego's operating system to spirit and Moses's operating system, the moment
right.
we do that, the obstacle is going to vanish or change in some way. And in terms of relationships, and I think this is one of the most beautiful things about A Course in Miracles, I mean, how many of us have been in a relationship that felt like a horrible obstacle? You know, you were talking earlier about, you know, trying to change someone. You know, if only he would do this, if only she
mm-hmm.
would. The moment we let it go, not from a place of, I give up, this is hopeless, but rather from a place of, I want happiness. I want love. I'm no longer attached to my way of doing it. What happens? That person somehow changes, as in the story I just told about, you know, this person and her father.
Right.
Bill Thetford used to share a story along these lines that I think is extremely illustrative of the power of forgiveness and the power of letting go. He worked, you know, in the psychiatry department, the psychology department at Columbia Presbyterian University, intensely academically competitive. And there was one guy whose name I will not mention, who just never liked him, and he never liked Bill. Bill never liked him. You know, he used to say every time he'd come up to him, the guy would go, "So, Thetford, what's new? You know, what you been doing? You know, like, you know." Both from a competition, you know, are you doing more than I'm doing?
Right.
As well as a subtle put down, like, have you done anything big lately?
You can hear the mockery in that statement.
Yes. It's just dripping with mockery.
Yeah.
So when Bill was, you know, receiving Course in Miracles with Helen and the emphasis on forgiveness, what he would do, he decided that he would get to work early every morning
mm-hmm.
and he would sit outside of this man's office. And he'd just meditate and practice forgiveness, in a sense, holding him in light and love before he got there. And then he'd go off and, you know, didn't tell anyone. But in doing that, he was switching operating systems. He was no longer seeing this man as an ego. He was recognizing him as a brother. And at a certain point, Bill said, one day Bill was, you know, sitting around eating almonds. And this guy walks up and says, you know, Thetford, you're eating almonds. Did you know that Edgar Cayce said almonds cure cancer? And Bill was thunderstruck that this guy would know anything about Edgar Cayce. So they started talking about Edgar Cayce.
Wow.
And that took them into a common area of interest. And the war was over. The rest is history.
Wow.
That's
so
forgiveness
just, he just
in
turned
action.
It around through forgiveness. Yes, absolutely. I've done that. I've heard so many accounts from students. And a lot of people don't believe that this is what really happens. They think miracles are difficult, I think, you know, and they think they're unworthy of miracles. And you know, with all that A Course in Miracles says about miracles, they are effortless. There is no size, you know, and they're completely natural. And we start to really believe that, you know, nothing will ever change. And in the Course of Miracles, it's hard to get some people, if I doubt that everyone listening to this is either actively practicing the Course or might be vaguely familiar and didn't think it was for them. And I think that's because, you know, when the ego is still operating in the forefront and that's your driving force is the ego, when you sit down to read something like A Course in Miracles, it's staggering. It's very staggering, and you start to think that even that is not real, the experience of integrating the text into your mind. And it even says in A Course in Miracles that you will find some of this material personally offensive.
That's
and
right.
I think it's because it's going to hit a button, and whatever you're most sensitive to, in whatever area where your ego is the most outraged, will create a sensitivity, a super sensitivity, and that's where the book is going to hit your buttons. And I've heard stories of people slamming the book shut, putting it in a closet, and locking the door, and they
Judy flushed it down the toilet.
Are you serious?
Oh, yeah. We've
you
all
flushed
struggled
it down the
with
toilet?
It. Yeah.
I
it in the toilet. Yeah.
I did not know that. Okay. And,
oh, yeah.
You know, there.
We've
I
struggled with it.
Yes. I eventually hit something and because it says, here's what you do, and here's what you think, and here's what you believe. And I eventually got to a point where I did kind of pull up and say, no, I don't. And, of course, the truth is, yes, you do. But I found a fence with that, and I said, okay, luckily, you know, I got back into a place of calm, and I was able to look at that. But the reason I like From Plagues to Miracles is for those of us that have experienced that, you know, we would certainly understand it more readily. But for anyone who wants to sit with A Course in Miracles and learn about themselves and learn about how the ego works and find the voice of their inner teacher, my recommendation, with your blessing, of course, is read From Plagues to Miracles first, because what you do is, you know, you take the beautiful, I now think this story of Moses and Exodus is beautiful, you take this story and we see into their world with our modern eyes, and it's almost like we want to cheer them on, like, no, don't give up, cross the Red Sea, no, you know, keep going, we know how the story ends, and we as people, none of us know how the story ends. We do not know what is written at the end of our scrolls. So we have to faithfully and with patience with ourselves allow that undoing of all of the miscreation, you know, our miscreating mind. We have to allow that undoing. But I say read From Plagues to Miracles first, because when you weave in, and I do want to talk about your psychotherapy practice, because I really love the personal accounts of your patients. And I think that anybody who wants to read a miracle should read this, because when we read someone else's story and we don't have something like the book pointing its finger at you and saying, here's what you do, and we don't want to believe that we do that to ourselves, by reading someone else's account and seeing how they're almost there. They're almost like that woman in the hospital who was in a lot of pain.
Oh, yeah. I call her Darlene.
Okay. Well, you guided her through a guided meditation, and Jesus came to her, and she was different, and she completely broke out of it. And I was so happy for her, and I was like a cheerleader, rooting for her, like, that's it. And then she reverted back to her previous state of being in pain and being enslaved to the body and whatever maladies. I can't quote it perfectly, but I think if we all read that and say, yes, I've done that to myself, maybe not to that extreme, but I have
absolutely
felt freedom, decided I was uncomfortable with it, and some of us say, I must be crazy, you know, in the way, because I had a lot of physical experiences when practicing the course, we start to think we're crazy. But to read someone else's account, then we're more readily aware and able to admit, yes, I do that to myself. So then when you go to the course and it says, here's what you do, here's what you think, and here's what you believe, it's not as abrasive to the ego because you're almost prepared for it. So I see From Plagues to Miracles as a primer to A Course in Miracles, literally.
You know, I never thought of it that way, but now that you lay that out, that makes a ton of sense. because I actually do think of Exodus as kind of a first stab at, quote, A Course in Miracles. It's not the A Course in Miracles that we know today, but it's trying to show us how to bring miracles into our lives. Mm-hmm. And for those who have never encountered A Course in Miracles, the language is heavily Christian, heavily. Yeah. It's very formal. The first, I don't know how many pages of the text can be very difficult to get through. In fact, I often tell people start somewhere else because if you open it at the beginning, you'll probably be turned off.
And it is the hardest part. Probably because it was so new to Helen and Bill.
Exactly right.
Especially where it says, you know, what's real and not real. It takes a while. You have to sit and look at that for quite a while and let it sink in first, and then you can move to understanding.
Yeah, so if you're new to this whole process, rather than, mm-hmm. Sort of trying to force your way into, the 1,000-plus pages of A Course in Miracles, go with a story that we all know, the story of Exodus, Moses, Pharaoh. I mean, even if you don't know it well, you've heard of it. It's been in the human psyche, in the collective unconscious for so long that I think it really does have an inner resonance with each of us. And I wanted to give real examples of how this stuff worked. I didn't want to just do some dry academic text that said, well, here's how the psychology works. I wanted to stick very closely to Exodus, and I think I did.
Right.
But bring it into the modern world and through the lens of spirituality to show how, how actual people have lived this and learned and transcended the problems that were there that they were facing.
Right.
So you had asked a little earlier about psychotherapy and talking about psychotherapy. Interestingly, Helen Schuckman actually channeled a whole pamphlet after A Course in Miracles called Psychotherapy, Purpose, Process, and Practice, which if you are a course student, I highly recommend.
You don't have to
be a psychotherapist to read it, and it's probably the most concise statement of the voice of Jesus on the nature of healing that you'll find perhaps in the entire course.
Mm-hmm.
But the way I look at it is this. We're not, most of us are not even close to what I'd call enlightenment, to that state of oneness with God. We're not knocking on the door of the promised land. And the thought of doing that would be so alien to our current sense of self that it probably would drive us insane.
Yeah.
So we each have to take our journey from where we are. If you want to get from, New York to L.A., you don't start in Columbus, Ohio. You start in New York, and you start driving from there. So
right.
We have to start where we are. And I think what psychotherapy does is psychotherapy is that first place where we ask for help and we acknowledge that we don't know the way there.
Okay.
In Exodus, God doesn't pay attention to the Hebrews, and Moses doesn't arrive on the scene, or rather, Moses does arrive on the scene, but he's not able to really be activated until the Hebrew people go, help! For those listeners who aren't students of A Course in Miracles, and maybe you're not even sure if you're on a spiritual path, and you have that sense of, I don't know, miracles, I mean, isn't that just for saints? Normal people don't have miracles. What I would pose to you is the following. Find some situation in your life where you truly don't know how to move through it, or where you thought you did, but your gut tells you that it's not going to work, and sincerely, genuinely let go and ask for help with no strictures, no preconceptions of what that help should look like or what the goal even is. Let go of it all. Just ask for help from your inner being, HS, Holy Spirit, Higher Self, either one, and then let it go and see what happens. Let it go and see what happens.
And once you show that willingness, they will jump in. They really will, and you will be guided. If you're open to it, you will be guided.
Yes, and that's the only way we can really know. I mean, we can read books out the wazoo, but mm-hmm. once you have that experience for yourself, You know it. It's not even a belief. It's not like, oh, well, I believe in this stuff. There's nothing to believe. You've experienced it. You know, it's kind of like someone saying to you, well, you know, do you really believe in gravity? I mean, are you sure? Isn't that just a theory? Well, no, I've thrown those apples up in the air and watched them drop. And, you know, when I fall into, I know gravity exists. So if you can allow yourself to go to that place of help, then, yes, miracles happen. And the one place in our world that I think human beings experience this all the time is in 12-step programs, whether it's Alcoholics Anonymous or Gamblers Anonymous or Sex Love Addicts Anonymous or Overeaters Anonymous. What is the first step? The first step in every one of them is we recognized we were powerless, i.e. our ego could not get us through.
Right.
And therefore, we turn to higher self, to God in whatever form we understand him. The 12 steps are a profoundly powerful spiritual path because they take us in that same direction. But check it out for yourself. Don't believe me. Don't believe Shahar. You know, try it. You'll see.
And with your blessing, I would like to use From Plagues to Miracles as a teaching tool in my classes and workshops, and I'll have to find a way to do that. Are you okay with that?
I am honored. I really am. You know, when I started writing From Plagues to Miracles, I thought it would be about a 50-page book that nobody would want to even look at. You know, I thought I'd self-publish it and my friends could put it in their bathrooms for, light reading material. and as I got into it more and more, I realized, okay, there's something here. But it's actually helped me to understand what Bill and Helen must have felt in terms of, wow, I kind of did that, and I don't know how I did it. You know, it was just on my path. It was my job. But I would be so honored for you to use it in your classes, and I'm honored that you're having me on your show here and that we get to talk about all of this and that it's even archived so that, you know, unlike 15 years ago when if you weren't tuned in live, you missed it. For posterity.
yes, and you're saying so many amazing things. I'm sure it's something that people will want to listen to more than just one time, for sure. But I wanted to how do you feel about taking some calls?
I think that's a perfect idea. That seems like we're at just the right time.
Okay. Well, we have Mr. Doug Anderson on the line, and Doug is calling in from Canada.
Hi, Bob. Hi, Char.
Hi, Doug.
Hi. Wow, what a great show today, you two.
Oh, thank you. It's flowing. It's definitely flowing.
Yeah, so, that's for sure. And Bob, I've just started reading your book, and I totally agree. My entrance into A Course in Miracles was through Marianne Williamson, A Return to Love.
You and many
that
people.
Was, you know, it was the only way that I got to it. And when I start reading your book, I go, yeah, this guy is on. You know, like it's you're practical, and you explain things in really, you know, like it's where the course, a lot of times it's like, what are they saying? Where reading your book, I'm going, I like this guy. Like I understand what you're, you know, and you're explaining it. And then another really powerful way of teaching that you're doing is then you're sharing the stories. And they, So far, and then, like, I highly recommend your book as well, and I also really enjoying reading it. And then to listen to you and Char talk today and just have a greater understanding of your past and how you came to write the book, and also your, you know, just when the author's talking about their book, it's just, you know, it's moving. So thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. I mean, one of the things that I actually didn't mention when we were talking about, you know, how in retrospect certain things happen for a reason is I spent 10 years as a screenwriter trying to get my movies produced in Hollywood. And we, you know, I had one produced. I've had a couple of options. I think it taught me how to write something that was captivating. I learned how to write my patients, you know, the stories of the people that I worked with. At the time, I didn't know that's what I was being trained to do, but in retrospect, I think that's what it was all about.
Yeah.
So, but thank you so much.
Yeah, I've got a question for you. Mm-hmm. Kind of going back back to the Bill Tetford days, and when he with that character that he was at odds with.
Yes.
And you talked about, you know, how he went through a forgiveness exercise, and where he went early to, you know, before anybody got there, and he did his meditation, and you explained that way of forgiveness. And one of the questions that I have is, there's many forms of forgiveness, and one of the ways that I really like to teach, which I think is what I'm getting from you as well, is when we're out there in real life and things are happening, how do we, you know, like, how do we grab onto this and use it? And a lot of times people, when we talk about forgiveness, there's a misunderstanding, or we don't really know what it is. I think for a lot of people it's intellectual, and then it's ineffectual, of course. So if you could kind of, you know, talk about forgiveness and maybe some of the different ways that you've come across, or you use, or recommend, or maybe even your time in the beginning with Bill, and kind of how they were discovering all, you know, the different ways as well.
That's an outstanding question. Forgiveness does not make an appearance in the Book of Exodus, which looks just at miracles, but it is probably the central theme of A Course in Miracles. And I agree with you, Doug. I think it's widely, sadly, misunderstood and misinterpreted. So what I'd like to do is kind of go run all the way to the top of the mountain and say, all right, here is kind of the pure essence of what forgiveness is from the perspective of Jesus in A Course in Miracles, and then come back down to the level at which we live, most of us still identified with ego to a greater or lesser extent, and talk about it from there as well. So to quote A Course in Miracles directly, in part two of the workbook, the Course says, "Forgiveness recognizes what you thought your brother did to you has not occurred." Now, I think that other than real dedicated long-term students of the Course, that makes no sense even. Because what do you mean it hasn't occurred? This person, you know, insulted me, or at the extreme end, you know, that drunk driver killed my wife. How can I forgive that person?
Yeah.
Now, these are the kinds of things that come up. So it almost feels fatuous and dismissive for someone to say, well, it never happened, just let it go. At the highest level of spirit, what the Course is saying is that this whole world we live in is a world of illusion. It does not have any quintessential intrinsic reality, because only God has reality. And God, according to the Course, is actually not a part of this world. God did not create this world, according to A Course in Miracles. We did, with sort of, you know, the ego mind with a capital E. So when the Course says forgiveness is the recognition that nothing really happened, that's a tough concept for most people to embrace. And we're also working off of the common understanding, where forgiveness means, yeah, you really did something nasty and lousy, you're a miserable sinner, but you know what, I'm so much better than you, I'll be the bigger man, and I will forgive you. I think the Course calls that forgiveness to destroy.
Yeah.
But that's the more common notion of forgiveness. So between those two, there's a pretty broad spectrum. And what you asked is, what are some of the different, you know, techniques for working with it? If you can recognize that, yeah, in the big picture, nothing ever did happen because, you know, we're in a nightmare. I mean, if you have a dream one night that someone does something really terrible to you, and you wake up the next morning, and it's kind of like, you know, do you call them on the phone and say, I am furious with you. Do you know what you did to me in my dream last night? I'm never going to forgive you. You know,
yeah.
That's not going to get you very far. In fact, it probably will create more need for forgiveness.
That'll get you on Maury Povich.
Yeah.
that'll get you right on to Maury Povich. I had a dream she cheated on me.
The woman
had a dream the guy cheated on her, and the guy says to Maury, he says, well, Maury, I had a dream that I won $1 million. I woke up and I was broke. And,
yeah, exactly.
But she believed this dream. Like, I know it sounds funny, but she actually believed this dream and thought he was cheating on her. It's ridiculous.
And look, and it probably broke up her marriage. So if we believe what happens to us in dreams, and the dream world we're living in being the penultimate dream, then we can't forgive. So at the highest level, it's the recognition that everything that happens here is in fact part of the dream, and the best way to deal with it is to wake up. So that's the run up the mountain. Now, coming back down to the level at which we all live, I think forgiveness starts with the recognition that, like the daughter and the father I was talking about earlier, that we are an active part of a dyad, of a tension, of a relationship with someone, that the only way we have to change it is not to change them, but to change us. That, therefore, forgiveness starts in our minds with a determination that we want to forgive. So it starts with an intention. If we don't want to forgive, then we won't, and then we probably shouldn't, and eventually we'll get the feedback for our lack of forgiveness, and hopefully at some point we realize that we'd rather be happy than be right, and that's where forgiveness will then come in. So the first step is recognizing that we want it, that it's a useful goal, that it's a desirable goal. Then the next step is, why am I holding on to this grievance? A Course in Miracles has at least three lessons in it at various points in the first half where we're told to call forth the picture of someone who we think has really, you know, slighted us, dissed us. You know, they say in each one, you already know who it is, and asks us to see them in the light, to see them as a brother. I mean, basically to do what Bill Thetford did with that colleague of his.
Yeah.
So once we have the intention to forgive, I would say to people, can you do something like that? And if they can, then that's a path forward. But for many people, you're a therapist, Doug, I believe. You also work with people.
Yeah, I'm a life coach. Life coaching and
same
training.
Thing.
And yeah.
Okay. So, you know, you're working with people like I am where, no, they're deep in the anger and fear. I mean, you know, I specialized for years in dissociative disorders, which are generated by the most horrific forms of child abuse. You know, how do you tell someone, well, look, you know, just forgive your stepfather. Yeah, he came in your room and, you know, digitally raped you every night, but, you know, what's the big deal? It never happened. I mean, you would never tell that to anybody.
Yeah.
So what do we want to do in those circumstances? We want to meet someone at the level that they're at, but meet them and hold in our own hearts and minds the knowledge that they are suffering, but that we temporarily have a better perspective, and in a sense, we can forgive for them. We can hold that love. We can share the love with them, not diminishing their experience whatsoever, and in fact, traveling it with them perhaps. Yes, that must have been horrible. What was it like? Helping them move into the emotionality of it rather than telling them to just deny it. Because as a therapist, what I see all the time is forgiveness used in service of denial. Well, you know, just get over it, forgive.
Oh, yeah, that's
horrible. But what it's really about is, no, don't feel what's there. Don't really heal that incident. You know, put it in the closet and lock it up somewhere. That doesn't help anyone.
No.
So as teachers of peace, and this can be us as professional therapists and coaches, but it could also be working with your brother or sister or your friend, to not judge what their experience is. It's so easy to think, I'm ahead of you, or I know what forgiveness is and you don't, to not judge them for where they are. I mean, the Course makes very, very clear that the purpose of time is to learn, and therefore we have time. So whether it takes someone an instant or whether it takes them 10 years to work that path of forgiveness, as long as they get there in the end, we're doing something good. And so I believe that if we can find the smallest increment of holding on, of grievance, of a sense of separateness and attack, they attacked me and therefore I'll attack them back, find the smallest place where it would be the easiest for someone to let go, and then, you know, just kind of work it backwards. Well, okay, no, obviously you can't forgive, you know, that rape, and you can't forgive this, and you can't, but, you know, what about the time that you wanted the Cocoa Puffs, and your mother said, no, you're having the healthy cereal this morning. You know, could you forgive that? Yeah, sure I could. And so we started moving, you know, in that direction. But I meet people where they are, and I actually think that there is a role for anger. In the course, I think it's lesson 333, Forgiveness Ends the Dream of Conflict here, and it says conflict must be resolved, and it must be resolved at the level that it exists. And, you know, that could be our credo as coaches and therapists. It's not about, you know, jettisoning someone to the top of the mountain where truly it never happened. It's recognizing that we're all here, we're all suffering to some degree. And I think this then segues into the Buddhist notion of compassion, which I think is very rich. I think it's actually the exact same thing as what A Course in Miracles talks about is forgiveness, just different languages, different translations. And compassion, you know, it has a different connotation, and often we can get to compassion. You know, even when someone does something horrible, sometimes we can think, well, what was the path that led that person to put that bomb there at the Boston Marathon? I mean, that must have been a horrible path. The action is horrible. I mean, there's no, you know, for most people, there is no forgiving that. But if we really understood, if we were in that person's shoes and brain for the entire length of their journey, we probably would find some compassion for it. And so I think, you know, that's how I work it. But I don't try to force feed forgiveness on anyone. I think that, you know, I try to put them in the hands of Holy Spirit and make sure that I'm in, you know, connected to my best self, and then, you know, let him run the show.
Yeah.
Does that help?
Oh yeah, totally. And I completely agree with you. I like most of the people that I work with. When they come to me, I say to them that at some point, either consciously or unconscious or subconsciously, you've decided that there's has to be a better way.
Yes.
And I just kind of feel into that when I say that to them. I don't say it to everyone, but it's pretty common. Just to find out where they're at, and when they go, yeah, I resonate with that. Then I know that they're ready. Still meet them where they're at, but I know they're ready. And then there's so many different ways in. And so that's why I was asking the question, is just to get some more, you know, like, because we all find, like when I'm talking to other coaches and I go, well, did you try this way? Or you know, how about, you know, this is what worked with this client. And then, you know, we just go, oh, that's brilliant, because it's so soft, but it just comes in on another angle. But I totally agree. If someone's not ready, then love's the answer. And, you know, I mean, it's always the answer even when they are ready, but it's just allowing them to have their course. But, yeah, it's awesome sharing. Thanks. Thank you very much.
I mean, I think it's a Buddhist saying that says, you know, if you're holding a grievance against someone or you're angry at them, and you know, it's like stabbing yourself through the stomach to stab them standing behind you.
Yeah.
And I think once the people we work with and the people who surround us recognize that holding that anger, that resentment, hurts us. It doesn't actually do anything to the other person. You know, we're the one with the hot coal in our hands. Then it's okay. Now it's more workable. You know, you're not doing. And I do suspect that if we were able to get into prisons and talk to people who murdered people out of revenge for things that were done to them, I suspect that doesn't give a whole lot of satisfaction.
Yeah.
I mean, there may be some people who go, I'm proud of it, and I'd do it again all over. And to those souls, I just think, okay, you've got a long way to go, and God bless.
Yeah, they're just hardened. They're just hardened so hard, that's all. But they'll soften.
Or it's a very young soul, you know, it's been around a few times and doesn't understand. And, you know, in the fullness of time, I know that will shift.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, that's great. That's super. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Did you have another question, Doug?
Oh, you want another one?
Sure. Bring it on.
I got lots of questions. I haven't read enough of your book, Bob, too, and I'm a little embarrassed, because it would be great to tie these questions right back into your book. So I you know, I do apologize.
That's okay.
The organization that I am a trainer with, we also A Course in Miracles is one of the foundation blocks. So it's always like my
wonderful.
Mind really works well with the course, and I know that your book is, you know, like Char and like you're saying, you know, easily is a bridge to the course, and of course you're so much of the course. But I do apologize for not asking more specific questions about Plagues to Miracles.
Hey, I'm just grateful you started it, and I will put in a pitch. I think it gets better. I think I had the most trouble actually with the first probably chapters 1 or 3, and at a certain point I believe it hits its stride, and and as Char was saying, hopefully helps people do some inner transformation work. But no apologies necessary. You know, I'm glad you've started it. So
yep.
Ask away.
Okay. Well, another thing that it actually happened to me today, but it happens a lot. Just being in the conversation, any conversation that leads towards, you know, like Plagues to Miracles, A Course in Miracles. I've written a book, and it's all down these lines, and sometimes people go, wow, that's deep. And it happened to me about an hour before the show, and I thought, you know, I'm going to bring this to the show. And I just like, and usually I go, yeah, like in my mind, I go, yeah, and I meet them where they're at and kind of let it go. And today what came out of my mouth, and I said, yeah, it's freedom. It's the path to freedom. And this gal looked at me, and then, you know, the subject got changed and so on and so forth. But so many times down the road of, yeah, I already know there's got to be a better way. Like if we start there, so we're not convincing anyone that it's their time to start on. Like I think in the course it says that A Course in Miracles says this isn't an optional course. It's just which lifetime are you going to take it?
Right. Free will does not mean you get to choose the curriculum. It just means that the time that you choose to take it is optional. You know,
right.
you can take it at different points. You can refuse it. But at some point, everybody has to take this curriculum.
Yeah. So start from my question will start of, at the place where somebody goes, they recognize, they may be in full fear, but they recognize, yeah, there's got to be a better way.
Okay, so they've expressed that intention.
Yeah, they've either, you know, they've expressed it in one form or another. And so meeting a person there, like say, so that would be our base point for this question. When somebody is, they know there's got to be a better way, and they're starting to clue in, like this gal today, she's cluing in that, oh my God, this is going to take me into my emotional body. And, you know,
by emotional body, you mean have feelings about it.
Yeah, like just feelings about it into my, you know, like technical terms, into my subconscious.
Okay.
You know, into heading into my subconscious unconscious, because that's where our emotional body is. Another way is this is going to start leading me down to my heart. And this is going to start hitting these places that I've blocked my heart. And you know, for so many of us, either we promise to never feel that again, because when we're, you know, most of our stuff comes, you know, from an early age.
From childhood,
and,
yes.
And but there's this, you know, like a lot of times this fear comes up, and it's just some different ways to approach somebody when they're at that very beginning stage. Because the way I look at kind of where society is at, I think we're moving so quickly, and consciousness is rising so fast, and there's like, I don't know if it's the masses yet, but it won't be long before there's, you know, a tremendous amount of people going, yeah, there's got to be a better way.
Then, from your lips to God's ears.
You know, and then, you know, it's from there, it means going, in my world, it means going into our feelings, going into our emotions, because it's through those blocks and traps that we head to happiness. Because it's my understanding is that's who we are. Like we don't, you know, it's inside us. It's not outside us. But when that, so that first, you know, when they start recognizing that, and then they kind of like deer in the headlights, I just kind of open that conversation up and to see how you handle that. Some of the, you know, some feedback or if that is a question.
It is. I don't know that it would be directly relevant to either Exodus or A Course in Miracles, but let me, you know, have a run at it. So what I hear you asking is what happens when somebody has feels kind of that first, you know, brief gust of, ooh, there's another way to do this. You know, the words of Bill Thetford to Helen, there must be another way than this intense pain and competitiveness of this environment that we're in. And in having that recognition, that insight, they realize that there is a lot of backed up emotion that they really don't want to feel because it was painful when they first felt it and they've walled it off and armored it off. And therefore it's kind of like, how do I open that up in order to, you know, to clean it out, to clear it out. Is that pretty much what you're?
Yeah.
Okay. You know, I mean, having worked with survivors of horrific abuse, one of the things I tell them, which is not original to me, I heard it from one of my mentors, is the slower we go, the faster we get there. Because what I experience a lot is someone coming in and when they have that insight, kind of going, okay, I see it now. Let's be done with it. You know, can you hypnotize me so that I can get through it? Or, you know, I want to just do this and get it over with. And I kind of say, well, you know, yeah, that's if you go to the dentist, that's what you do. But notice that that's what you're saying is I'm still afraid of it. And you can't undo fear by, in a sense, trying to anesthetize yourself and run away from it. So once again, why are you afraid? You know, what are you afraid of? Where is it going to take you? I mean, in course terminology, there are only two emotions, love and fear. So every negative emotion, you know, seen through the course is sort of a refraction, a subset of fear. As a therapist, I believe there are actually, you know, four negative affects, shame, fear, anger, and sadness or distress, and that, you know, these get put together in various combinations to make any other emotion word on the negative end. But the way I try to explain it to people, and again, this is talking as a therapist, more as a therapist and less as a conduit for Holy Spirit, but the way I would put it is that emotions are a feedback system, and they work particularly well in the arena of relationships. So our senses are a feedback system for the physical world. If I touch a hot stove, I get burned, I pull away, and what I take in as memory is, wow, I don't want to touch that stove anymore. And that's a useful thing. You know, as long as we're bodies, we need that kind of thing to survive. I'm standing at a street. I want to use my eyes to see if any cars are coming before I cross over. We need that level of feedback. What happens with emotions in the arena of relationship is, you know, we're in a relationship, you know, we idolize our father and he tells us, oh, what, you don't know how to hammer in a nail? What are you, an idiot? And now we feel exquisite shame. And so the feedback we get from that emotion is it hurts and we pull away. And maybe we don't want to hammer nails with our dad anymore. Or maybe we turn it into anger and, you know, well, you know, dad's a nail hammerer and I hate nail hammerers. But we sort of, unlike the hot stove where, you know, you learn it pretty fast and you're not holding on to it in any way. I mean, you don't say, oh, my God, I'm never going to get a stove. Those things are terrible. With emotion, we do that. So I try to recast emotion as just a feedback system for learning about relationships. And this then takes us back to the Course, because I think what A Course in Miracles does that no other spiritual system that I'm aware of does is it says the road to healing necessarily lies through relationship. You know, the temple of the Holy Spirit is not a body, it is a relationship. It's you and your brother. And that the path to salvation involves healing our relationships. So in that regard, if we can sort of detoxify emotion, affect, and see it as just part of the learning system. You know, when we feel sad, it's telling us that we've experienced a loss, we've experienced a hurt, and we need to move through that and grieve and let it heal. You know, maybe that loss was inappropriate, but maybe it's completely appropriate. You know, if someone you love dies, don't expect to feel happy or move right through it. There's something there, a form of love that we experience that we no longer have. So you know, emotions neither need to be put on a pedestal nor avoided. They're just another tool for discovering how we have been in relationship and what patterns we've learned that keep us from taking those relationships and turning them into vehicles for experiencing love, and ultimately for experiencing the love of God and Holy Spirit, the love of oneness. You know, love thy neighbor as thyself, meaning don't love him the way you love yourself. It's not about narcissism. It's he is yourself. She is yourself.
Yeah.
But I think emotion is it's a feedback system, and you know there's some very good stuff. I mean, I was brought up on the work of a guy named Sylvan Tompkins, who did a ton of work on what emotion really is about. He's almost unreadable though, but one of my mentors, a psychiatrist by the name of Don Nathanson, wrote about shame in particular. But very nice entry into looking at emotion from a whole different perspective that I think is actually very healing. So a little off the topic for perhaps some of the listeners, but good stuff. Thank you, Doug.
Yeah, and thank you. I think when I started to listen to your answer there, Bob, is that I think when people are reading, you know, if they're not A Course in Miracles student or somewhere down that line, and they pick up from Plagues to Miracles, what may happen is they'll start moving into that emotional body. So I started hearing it, I just went, oh my God, this is brilliant, your answers. And you know, especially this feedback system for relationships, because it certainly, I think it will tie into your book for the readers, because they'll go, oh, this is what's coming up.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what came to me while you're sharing that. And I'll certainly learn from this as well, and thank you so much.
Thank you, Doug.
Yep.
Thank Char, you so much, Doug.
Yeah, thank you, Char.
Okay, I'm going to put you on mute.
Alrighty.
All right, dear.
Okay.
Do we have any other questions?
Were you talking to Doug?
No, I was just asking whether we have anyone else on the line for questions or whether whether
we
want to wind it up.
No, I actually, listening to you two, brought a couple things to mind.
Great.
And like I said, you know, great questions and great answers. That was really, whether it was off topic or not, was fascinating. So
Thank you.
I'm great with that. But as you were talking about emotions and all that you said about, you know, how to use them, it just kept reminding me of Helen Schuckman. And not to have this, you know, dripping sympathy for her. I know she played her role. It was a very important role.
Critical,
yes. And that couldn't have been easy, giving birth to this and then wrapping your mind about, especially with her background of atheism and psychology and all of this. But as I learn more about her relationship with Dr. Thetford,
mm-hmm.
And my understanding is that, you know, the tension, the fighting, except when they were working on or talking about A Course in Miracles, I feel that, you know, I understand that Helen didn't do the lessons, but Bill did.
Well, I think she went through them once, yes.
She did?
But I
wish she could have gotten to the point where if she had really integrated all that A Course in Miracles is into her subconscious mind, you know, it came through her. But if she had turned that around and integrated it, I think she would have found, ultimately, that she really was, like, she thought she was in love with Dr. Pfeffer. But I think if she had really embraced all of these concepts and learned as much about herself as perhaps most of us have, she would have discovered that she was not in love with him at all. It was just an ego attachment, and she applied a romantic notion to it. Because in learning about Bill, and I really feel connected to him. And it seems to me that, you know, when somebody is that loving, he has a very calm presence to me, and something that makes you feel like you almost want to, and you tell me because you're his friend, when I think about him and if I kind of tap in and get a sense of him, I feel like I want to go limp. I feel like I become very calm, and I feel at home when I think about Dr. Pfeffer. And you can say yay or nay, but when someone gives off that kind of love the way he did, and that emanation of peace, I think it's easy for the ego to look at that and translate it for its own devices as, oh, that must be romantic love, and you develop this romantic attachment, and then when that person doesn't return it, you're not going to sit down, look at it, and think, like, oh, they weren't emanating a romantic love towards me. That's how they love everybody. I must have misinterpreted. But the ego just sinks its claws into, and this happens to people, you know, especially those of us who've ever been in a relationship, you know, an unrequited love relationship. And I think that's one of the hardest things to rip from your grip, because to be in love with somebody and not have them return your affections is a nightmare. But I think that, I could be wrong. Tell me if I'm dead wrong, but I think that's what Helen was going through. And I wish she had gotten to that point where she could have released herself from that prison. Am I hitting on anything incorrectly, or you're just,
well, you know, agree or disagree? I'm not in a position to be able to answer it, because I knew Bill mostly. I mean, I knew him in New York, but I, you know, got to know him much better after he had already moved to out to California, while Helen stayed in New York. And I think. Because he was such a devoted practitioner of A Course in Miracles, he did take on that sense of presence and peacefulness. But like all of us, you know, he had plenty of dirty laundry. I think he was extraordinarily shame-bound about his homosexuality, as most men who in that era who were homosexual were. But I think to your point, I mean, a huge section of the text addresses the special love relationship, which is the ego's way of, in a sense, trying to sort of, you know, perform this, you know, crafty little twist and turn and make us think that, see, here's love, and here's what we want from our brother. I don't think he's going to attack me. He loves me, and I love him. And I mean that could be a whole, you know, a whole discourse in and of itself. And you're right, the unrequited love relationship is one of the most painful things. I actually share something in From Plagues to Miracles of one of my own experiences of that.
Right.
But I you know, whether Helen would have gotten there or not, you know, I don't know. I do agree with you that had they been in a position where they could have gone forward, worked the course together, I have no doubt that their special relationship in its whatever form it took would have become a holy relationship. I do know, and I recall very well, Bill one day just kind of looking at me with this very sad look on his face. It may have been, you know, when Helen was sick and very resentful and, you know, calling out there every day, deeply unhappy, you know, looking at me and just kind of shrugging his shoulders and saying, you know, I didn't think it was supposed to turn out this way. So I think he believed that she would move out to California and become a practitioner of the course. And, you know, and and form that holy relationship. And I know that he was, you know, deeply sad that that didn't happen, but he did not let it stand in the way of his own work and his own path.
Yes.
And I think that that would be the lesson, is that sometimes people that we love, you know, they can't go all the way with us. I give an example in From Plagues to Miracles of a man I worked with, a very dear man who made some huge gains, but reached a point where it was kind of like he just couldn't go any further. He was a professional thief and needed to stop that, but once he did, he had no other identity to go to. And I did not take it at all as a failure that I couldn't help this man go further than he did. It was, you know, within this lifetime,
yeah.
My sense is that was his goal. He completed his goal, another start, another personality structure in order to go further.
Right.
And so I have to assume that something like that was true for Helen. I think she did her job. And you know, when she asked Jesus, the voice of Jesus, why me? The answer she got is because you'll do it. And how many of us, you know, could have the knowledge of psychology that she had and hear a voice in our heads saying, this is A Course in Miracles, please take notes,
mm-hmm.
and actually do it and stick with it and not feel like we were going nuts or that we were so special that we would go on some messianic mission. I actually think her atheism and her skepticism allowed her to keep her fingerprints off the material by and large. And I think there were at least one place where that did not happen, and at some point I will probably write an article on that, but I'm not willing to go into that today.
Okay.
But for all intents and purposes, for, you know, 99.999% of the material, do an amazing job of keeping her ego out of it. And I think if she somehow were a true believer, that maybe it wouldn't have gone that way. I have to assume that, you know, in God's plan, all things work out the way they're supposed to work out, and that what looks like a tragedy to you and me sitting here, and certainly felt like that to Bill, probably had a higher purpose and made sense for,
yes.
you know, for who she was.
In the larger picture. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in the larger picture. Because she was a remarkable human being. I mean, I didn't know her well, but I certainly met her on many occasions when, you know, when she was at Judy's, you know, New York City home. And
right.
From what I've, you know, learned, she was very much almost a dual personality. You know, if someone came to her with a spiritual question or asked her for help, boy, I mean, she could bring in truth, capital T, like no one
really?
Else. Yeah. But then in her own personal life, you know, she didn't have that access or chose not to use it.
Or chose not to, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
But I think she, you know, she did her job, and what more can any of us say? You know, I did my job, and, you know, maybe the next lifetime has a different job.
Sure.
But I think Bill had, you know, whether because he wasn't the channel or because, I don't know why, you know, went further and really did that inner work, and certainly by the end of his life, I believe, and everyone who knew him believed, and he certainly believed that, you know, he'd healed all of his relationships.
That's beautiful.
You know, he had forgiven everyone.
And I'm happy that he's at peace. And what many might not be aware of is that July 4th marked the 25th anniversary of his passing.
Yes.
And I just want to say, I'm very sorry for the loss of your friend, even though time has passed, and I know you're probably at a very good space with it, but he was your friend.
Oh, yeah, I feel him there all the time.
Yes, but he was your friend, and I know that loss is bittersweet. So I just want to say, you know, I'm sorry for the loss of your friend, and I wish I wish for something different than what I have, but it would have been so nice to meet him, and I love his energy. And
yeah.
We have
Well, Carol House. Carol Howe's book is wonderful in that regard, and you know, if you want to get a sense of who Bill Thetford was, it's a good read. It's got lots of great stories in it. I mean, it really does bring Bill to life for those who didn't know him. But for me, and I know Judy feels this way too, I mean, mm-hmm. we feel like Bill's there. It's kind of like in Star Wars, you know, Obi-Wan Kenobi gets killed, but Luke Skywalker has access to him, all the better for the fact that he's no longer in the physical body. You know, he can help channel the Force better because he's not in the physical. Well, and I think Bill is here today. You know,
yes,
absolutely. He's smiling and kind of nodding, and Bill had this unusual talent. Bill could wiggle his ears and do it in quite a striking way. So in the middle of a conversation, someone would be weighing in on something very deep and heavy and spiritual, and Bill would just kind of look at me and wiggle his ears, and, you know, you'd want to laugh, but you couldn't. You know,
yeah,
Bill's there wiggling his ears right now.
and as a clairvoyant medium, I have to agree with you 100%. But we have just a couple minutes left, and yes, last week when I was talking to Carol, I actually felt pressure on my heart and felt somebody's hand pushing on my heart. So I'm pretty convinced that was Dr. Pfeffert, and I just couldn't wrap my mind around it at the time. But just to ask very quickly before we go, I want to thank you once again for sharing all of your knowledge and your heart with all of us. And from Plagues to Miracles, for me, you know, is a miracle. So I look
thank
forward
you.
To sharing that with as many people who will let me. But for just one last question, if you had one piece of advice to offer all the fellow travelers on their own Exodus journey, what would that be?
Oh, the old, if you had one wish or one piece of advice.
Right.
I think it really is that idea that the ego sets up idols and believes that it knows what God is in some form of material or earthly happiness, and that we really don't, that the ego doesn't know what it wants, that the ego is confused, it will seek and it will never find, and that the only thing that will really bring us deep inner peace, true happiness, enduring, lasting happiness, the only thing will be the memory, and I don't mean remembering as in the past, I mean the return of the felt experience of who we are, you know, the sons of God, the daughters of God, the children of God.
Right.
And therefore, make that your quest. Try to strip away anything that gets in the way of that. You know, A Course in Miracles says, I think it's lesson 188, enlightenment is a recognition, not a change. It's always there. It's just covered over with all
mm-hmm.
kinds of crud and dirt and nonsense. And, you know, our job is to undo all of that so that we can experience truth. So I guess that's what I would say, and that to the extent that we're on that path, we'll get plagues where ego is still got its tentacles and hooks into us, and all that means is pay attention, look there, and we will have miracles, and the miracles are the examples of flow and examples of how life works when we're aligned with our higher self.
It's all about
I would
alignment.
Also like to, in terms of my book, From Plagues to Miracles, people often ask, well, where can I get it? I mean, it's
yeah.
available in all ebook formats, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, independent bookstores, you could order it. Hopefully, if you've got a New Age bookstore in your area, they would have it. And if they don't, ask them to order it for you. But it is widely available. It's published by Hay House, and they do a very good job of distribution. You should be able to find it anywhere.
Yes, and on the show page, ladies and gentlemen, there are also several links for you to follow. Visit Dr. Bob's website. Get this book, please. This will, if you only have one revelation, it would be the one that you need. But I had many, and I had to take notes. It really pushed me back about 10 feet and provided such excellent reminders. And I was able to look at myself a little differently and a little more deeply as a result, and then to really see how it provides that bridge to A Course in Miracles. It can, if you are a teacher of A Course in Miracles, get this and you'll see what I mean. Well, I have about 60 seconds. Dr. Bob, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you to Doug Anderson.
Yes.
For joining us and asking his brilliant questions. He is really He's doing a lot of great things with the course. He has written a book. I'm going to have him on next week as a guest, and we're going to talk about that. But thank you very much for your time and for sharing
your
experience with Dr. Pfeffer. You're welcome. And it's been so fascinating learning more about Dr. Pfeffer and Helen Schuckman and the whole process and the beginning and how wonderful that is. So thank you very much, and thank you, everyone, for tuning in. We have about 10 seconds to say God bless. Thank you to Dr. Robert Rosenthal.
God bless, miracles for all.
And miracles for all. Be at peace, everyone. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.